Well, here's a good place to start. Is there an easy lesson to learn in writing? That's the question. Not what are the hard lessons, but what are the easy ones? where the commas go. But even that, I've struggled with. Now,
nobody cares about commas, though, so it's obviously not even an easy lesson. It's got to be an easy lesson that matters, right?
Well, what I decided is now I've just fallen into using the dash. Because with the dash, nobody can ever tell you you're wrong. Nobody's ever like, that's the wrong use of a dash.
Dashers are fantastic because they're not as intrusive as parentheses.
Or maybe, yeah.
And they just kind of block it, you know, and... So when are you going to start this thing?
I started it.
You started it? Well,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, okay. I have to toast my compadre, Jonah, who has just got the Limberlost Review out by the Postman, and Jonah's great piece on Robert Persig's Lila. And... here's to Rick and Rosemary Ardinger and Limberlost Review, man. It's beautiful, beautiful. Everything I've read's been really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic kind of literary review. I mean, I don't know how. I don't even know who listens to this podcast. I don't know what, like, if we talk about literature, in to what extent that's even interesting to people. You know, like, if we're going to start with Murakami, right. And so we're going to start with Murakami, and specifically that the Rise and Fall of Sharpie Cakes, which is essentially an allegory about his problems with the literary establishment in Tokyo.
I'm glad you arrived at that, because that was what my son Rolf said. Yeah, and that's absolutely right.
Well,
yeah.
No, it's right in the introduction to.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
oh, right.
He says right in the introduction.
Right.
That's what it's about. But. Here's my question to you.
Gentle reader, this is why you should read the introduction. I did not read the introduction.
How can you stay away from an introduction?
I started reading it.
Well, it's a little bit fey. I don't know.
The cool thing about it was, is I read the whole thing really not seeing it. And then on the last line, he tells you, but I really didn't see it. So it was nice not being set up.
Actually, yeah, it's probably better that way. Because as a literary allegory,
nothing for Murakami to even paraphrase his writing is. I'm surprised that didn't repel you completely.
It did, kind of. It did a little bit. Yeah. It was. I don't know. It was. It's just a little too nice.
But he's a nice writer.
Yeah, he's a little too nice for my taste. Yeah, he's a little too...
He is the ultimate modernist. I had this beautiful young woman come in and tell me, give me the definition of modernism. And basically modernism is, right about the 1880s and 90s, writers started just investigating relationships just between real people. I mean, real stuff, right?
Yeah.
No heroes, no knights. No damsels in distress, none of this. And I'm kind of glad I brought that up, because I was thinking, since we had talked about doing a survey of American heroic writing and contrasting Hemingway and Hunter S. Thompson, right?
Yeah.
And Hunter S. Thompson's heroic drug taking, right?
Right.
And then you got Murakami, who is like, totally anti. I mean, he's ultra-ly modern, and I think that's the point. Hemingway and Hunter S. Thompson are not modernists. They are going back to the medieval knight who, with use of alcohol or whatever, you know, fights the dragon, you know, and Hunter S. Thompson goes into that big, I'm sure horrific, meeting room in Las Vegas, and there are like 10,000 fucking cops there, you know.
Yeah.
And he's like as stoned as you could get, right? So I think that's pretty heroic. But Murakami is like, no, it's just total modernism, and he just develops. He's the nicest guy you're ever going to hang out with, you know? He's going to listen to you, and he's going to tell you the story without any pro forma prefab stuff.
Phone call. Phone call for the bookstore. Phone call, please. You can answer it. We can stop it. That's fine.
No, no, nobody's going to interrupt this brilliant conversation.
Now it's
brilliant. We're also drinking Miller High Life, gentle listener. So yeah. But yeah, this was the general idea we talked about, or yeah.
Pretty much. So yeah. Should we read something from Murakami just to kick it off a little? Mm-hmm. What do you think? What's your opinion?
Well, I actually like that. You know, the lead piece is Blind Willow Sleeping Woman, but you had other things. You like the satire of the Sharpie
gun. Well, I'm not sure I like that necessarily.
I also have to tell you that I read
another call, incoming call.
I also
your bookstore is getting so busy these days.
Right.
It's all thanks to the podcast.
It's
to the podcast. You're becoming famous.
At least you know we're in real time here, and we are drinking Miller High Life. So there's right. No.
You can leave it.
Is no elitist thing here going here. All I have to do is take this off, right? I don't have to really unplug it.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything. You can just leave it. But now I'm curious. Who was calling?
You know,
that
they might be a writer, you know, that's listening to the podcast.
right now, going live. We're live.
We are now live
to the world.
Call 208-233-0821.
Tell us
this is your chance.
Actually, we were talking about that the other day, about how we could maybe do a live show.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that might be kind of fun, because it's like, you know, we're not going to do 100 of these things. You know, I think we should try and jam pack as much, you know,
right,
content into these articles that we're leaving behind, these artifacts, as you once told me that I loved so much.
It's right, like, right. Well, we both love artifacts. I myself have a certain dysfunctional ambivalence towards the fact that I love artifacts, but let's face it.
Dysfunctional ambivalence. That's a good...
Oh, yeah, man. When you realize that all your sorrows have led to creating an artifact, and that's all it is, man. You know, granted, it's beautiful, and that's what it's all about, right? So anyway, what we're going to do now is we're going to ask people to call in, and... we're going to be able to figure it out, so we can put like the phone right up to the mic.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely not going to do that.
Okay, back to Murakami. Murakami is a modernist. It's all about relationships. And it's interesting also that... So then I read A Folklore for My Generation.
Yeah.
And, man, well, one thing my son did tell me was that the Murakami is just recreating the Orpheus myth over and over again, and it is, it's the lost love, right? And everything I've read, other than Sharpie Crows, has been that. And
lost love, yeah.
Well, yeah, the female that drifts away, and of course, blind Willow Sleeping Woman is like definitely Orphic.
Which is the name of the collection that we wrote.
Right, right.
I don't know if he has another short story collection. I'm sure he probably does. But
right.
This is a collection of his stories, some of them which were from the 80s, and then some that he published before this book, which was published in 2006, I believe. And I just want to read a little bit of it before I go into my thoughts on it. So I guess I'm just going to read this one, because this is the most compelling I found his style, even though I know it's a folklore for my generation, a prehistory of late stage capitalism. I was born in 1949, entering junior high in 1961 and college in 1967, and reached my long-awaited 20th birthday, my intro into adulthood, during the height of the boisterous slapstick that was the student movement, which I suppose qualifies me as a typical child of the 60s. So there I was, during the most vulnerable, most immature, and yet most precious period of life, breathing in everything about this live-for-the-moment decade, high on the wildness of it all. There were doors we had to kick in, right in front of us, and you better believe we kicked them in, with Jim Morrison, the Beatles, and Dylan blasting out the soundtrack to our lives. There was something special about the 60s. That seems true now, in retrospect, but even when I was caught up in the whirlwind of it happening, I was convinced of it. But if you asked me to be more specific, to pinpoint what it was about the 60s that was so special, I don't think I could do more than stammer out some trite reply. We were merely observers, getting totally absorbed in some exciting movie, our palms all sweaty, only to find that, after the house lights came on and we exited the theater, the thrilling afterglow that cursed through us ultimately meant nothing whatsoever. Maybe something prevented us from learning a valuable lesson from all this. I don't know. I'm way too close to the period to say. I'm not bragging about the times I lived through. I'm simply trying to convey what it felt like to live through that age, and the fact that there really was something special about it. Yet if I were to try and unpack those times and point out something in particular that was extraordinary, I don't know if I could. What I'd find if I did such a dissection would be these: the momentum and energy of the times, the tremendous spark of promise, more than anything else, the feeling of an inevitable irritation, like when you look through the wrong end of a telescope. Heroism and villainy, ecstasy and disillusionment, martyrdom and betrayal, outlines and specialized studies, silence and eloquence, people marking time in the most boring way, they were all there for sure. Any age has all these. The present does, and so will the future. But in our age, to use an exaggerated term, these were more colorful, and you could actually grasp them. They were literally lined up on a shelf right before our very eyes. Nowadays, if you try to grasp the reality of anything, there's always a whole slew of convoluted extras that come with it. Hidden advertising, dubious discount coupons, point card stores hand out that you know you should throw out but you still hold on to. Options that are forced on you before you know what's happening. Back in our age, nobody plunked down indecipherable 3-volume owner's manuals in front of you. Whatever it was, we just clutched it in our hands and took it straight home. Like taking a baby chick home from one of those little nighttime stands. Everything was simple and direct. Cause and effect. Cause and effect were good buddies back then. Thesis and reality hugged each other like it was the most natural thing in the world. And my guess is that the 60s were the last time that'll ever happen. A prehistory of late-stage capitalism. That's my own personal name for that age. Let me tell you a little bit about the young girls back then. And us guys with our nearly brand new genitals and the wild, joyous, sad sex we had. That's one of my themes here. Take virginity, for instance, a word that, for some unfathomable reason, always reminds me of a field on a beautiful sunny spring afternoon. In the 60s, virginity was a much bigger deal than it is today. I'm generalizing, of course, I haven't taken a survey or anything, but my sense of it is that about 50% of the girls in my generation had lost their virginity by the time they reached 20. At least among the girls I knew, that seemed to be the case. Which means that about half of the girls, whether they made a conscious choice or not, were still virgins. It strikes me now that most of the girls in my generation, the moderates, you might dub them, whether virgins or not, agonized over the whole issue of sex. They didn't insist that virginity was such a precious thing, nor did they denounce it as some stupid relic of the past. So what actually happened, sorry, but I'm generalizing again, was that they went with the flow. It all depended on the circumstances and the partner. Makes sense to me. So on either side of this silent majority, you had your liberals and your conservatives, the entire spectrum, from girls who practiced sex as a kind of indoor sport to those who were firm believers in remaining pure till they got married. There were guys, too, who were adamant that whoever they married had to be a virgin. Like every generation, there were all kinds of people, with all kinds of values. But the big difference between the 60s and the decades before and after was that we were convinced that someday all those differences would be overcome. Peace! Exclamation point.
That's so great. Beautiful reading.
Without an exclamation point.
Beautiful reading, man. Oh, Haruki, man. What a great writer. Well, what a great writer. There's a legalistic. He's setting up this whole story about this guy who does run into a woman who wants to be a virgin.
Yeah.
Even though she and loves him deeply. And but just, in other words, he runs into this crazy woman and loves her totally at the most delicate time of his life, right? Between like 15 and 20, 16 and 20.
Yeah.
And he sets it up so beautifully with this picture of the age, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just spectacular, man. I agree. You picked the best story in the book.
Well, I think it's the best because it's the closest to me that comes to actually saying anything at all.
Right.
I mean, all the rest of them, I'm kind of like. Eh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's he's a mixture. And the other thing I have to say tell you is that who is his real progenitor? It's Sherwood Anderson. I mean, I'm reading this and I'm going, Sherwood Anderson all the way. I mean, he's always going, I've had this funny, you know, thought. I can't quite figure it out. And he tells you that. He goes, God, I just can't work it out. It's kind of started with, you know, I just heard this on the street or she said this or something. And then he kind of works through it with you, right?
But Sherwood Anderson
in this
always...
false naivety. It's a false naivety.
Yeah.
And
that's true of Sherwood Anderson.
And Murakami gets away with it somehow, but not totally because you don't like that style, right?
Well, I mean, I like Sherwood Anderson's Weinsberg because he chooses these individual characters and just sort of gives them their own little sketch.
Yeah.
With Murakami, he's all, I actually kind of like this about Murakami is he sort of always inserts himself mm-hmm. into mm-hmm. a large percentage of mm-hmm. his stories.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I can be more specific because I thought about it this month and I remember I first picked up the Wind Up Bird Chronicle, his novel, and I was reading through it and I was like, okay, I'm not getting enough here, because that was the period of my life where I was just obsessed with mind. I'm like, okay, this book doesn't have enough mind. On to the next one. Where's the one that's going to help me understand reality? You know, and Murakami's more gentle than that. And I'm not in any way saying that I dislike him or that he's bad or anything like that. I want to preface that, but I think I pinpointed what bothers me about him is that he never takes a risk. There's never a sentence in this book where I'm like, what? Like, what does that mean? Like, where I have to think about it for 2 seconds, you know? He never takes... And I've been reading Thompson, too, and, like, Thompson's the opposite. Thompson's taking all kinds of these wild, wacky risks all over the place, right. And most of them don't work.
Right, right.
But Murakami is almost... It's very safe. It's...
Right, he's in total control, but that's the Japanese, you know, the Japanese thing. I mean, and if I were to use a phrase, it would be, he deals in these atmospherics of relationships. I mean, blind willow, sleeping woman. I mean, this is just like atmospherics of ambiguity and, you know, what's going on here. And when it actually starts to coalesce.
But what's ambiguous in that story?
Oh, everything is. Totally everything is.
Well, that's a cop-out, and you know it.
Well, I'd have to reread it and and have it in front of me, and that's your job, not mine. But I'm just telling you that it finally coalesces when she develops, when the girl announces that she has this dream, you know, of this blind willow, right? And these... And so now you're kind of getting... this metaphorical kind of strange image, fairy tale image, that is delineating all the ambiguity of her relationship with her boyfriend and her relationship with Murakami, the narrator. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's Hemingway all the way, you know, I mean, he's suppressing all the meaning and it's just kind of coming out here and there and in metaphors. I think it's fantastic, but it's definitely atmospheric, you know. And I just picked up some, you know, Japanese scroll painting in pen and ink, you know, and it's like you just have, you know, you have a little island with maybe a fir tree in there, and then you got some mist, and then you got, and it's all separated by space, right?
And their
So,
paintings are beautiful. I mean,
right.
they're
Well,
woodcut
I think
prints.
Murakami's I think Murakami's paintings are beautiful too. I'm gonna open up. Jonah will attest, I open it up at random.
True, 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 true
Crabs.
fact.
Crabs. Ironically, gentle listener, I opened up to this paragraph. He left the bathroom, leaned back against the door, and surveyed the bedroom. His girlfriend was in bed, fast asleep. Face sunk deep in her pillow, she was snoring peacefully, oblivious to what had transpired. Like a delicate fan, her long hair covered her cheeks, her shoulders. Just below her shoulder blades were two small moles, lined up like a pair of twins. Her back revealed a clear swimsuit line. Light from the whitish moon tranquilly filtered in through the blinds, along with the monotonous sound of waves against the shore. On the bedside, the green numbers of the alarm clock glowed. Nothing had changed. Except now the crab was inside her. That evening they'd shared the same dishes, only she wasn't aware of it. Well, now we have to read that short story.
I think I did actually.
Really?
I read most of them, I think.
Right, so is it any good?
I don't know. I don't know. It's I don't know anymore.
Well, it's tonal realism, you know. I mean, he's just kind of like, but it's definitely got the light. It's got just the simplicity of image, you know. And anyway, I always like that stuff. I like him a lot. And so, what novel should I read by him?
Well, I'm a terrible judge of that, but I'd love to hear what you think of Kafka on the Shore.
Okay, I've got it.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, and I would love to be convinced to read one of his novels. I just don't feel like, and maybe I just got to get over it. Maybe it's something of my own self that's obsessed with just like learning things or something. Like I'm obsessed with like
Right.
if this novel or story
Right.
doesn't teach me anything,
Right.
then I'm
Right.
at a loss for what I'm even doing here.
Right, and you're right, and that's why I have to that's why I have to change my judgment that he's a modernist. He's a modernist that's not really going to tell you anything about anything. He's got their human relationships, but he's telling you there's nothing to learn, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, even the even but even the relationships, it's hard to understand what he's pinpointing or what,
That's what I was saying.
like, yeah, but in any relationship, couldn't you find some fulcrum on which the relationship exists? I
Right.
mean,
Right. That would be classical.
That's classical.
That would be classical, sure, yeah.
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 And modernism is to say to reject. Oh no,
No,
sorry.
no. I mean, there's, yeah, you're supposedly looking for causes, but basically, no, just a total field of study, right, is, you know, Henry James or, you know, whomever, James Joyce. You're talking about relationships, and well, I really limit it only to the idea there's no more heroic. That's all I'm saying. I refuse to get
Yeah.
put my marker down any
Yeah.
bigger than that. And so now we're going to go back to my original one, which was the idea of the heroic, right? And I talked to this woman. I was saying, you know, the great unknown writer Jonah Andrist, on our podcast, we're going to do this podcast on heroism. And I said, you know, I was having a hard time coming up with a woman in the heroic mode, not the modernist, the heroic. And like we're talking about, like Wuthering Heights, that's modernist, right? I mean,
Right.
this is human beings locked in.
Right.
And actually, Faulkner as well is purely modernist,
Right.
just in terms of, look, we're going to work with what we have, right?
Right. Yeah.
And And she said, Penelope, the wife of Odysseus, for 10 long years, keeping these suitors at bay, these horny suitors at bay, and keeping the hearth there for when her husband comes home, right? And I thought that was fantastic. And I thought, well, isn't it interesting that, yes, the last heroic woman is in the heroic age, the Greek age of 1700 BC, when, yes, you know, men and women were pretty heroic, right?
Well, that would be an interesting idea for a novel, wouldn't it? Like, you just do a novel of Penelope staying at home and,
right.
Is she so beautiful that she's beating off these suitors with a bat? Like,
she's got a lot of money. She's got a, Odysseus is a king.
Right.
She's got a lot of, she's got a lot of money, and she's only got one son to screw things up, right?
But she has to have some reason for doing that. That's heroic, right? I mean,
well, of course, love.
Well, love isn't heroic. I don't think love is heroic.
That's what I love about you, man. You come up with these great. You're right. You come up with lines nobody'd ever thought about. That's great, man.
Well, I mean, love is love. It's not heroic. It's well, maybe nothing is heroic, but maybe being the tending a fire that nobody on the planet gives a shit about except for you, maybe that is heroic, you know. Like, and maybe it has nothing to do with Odysseus. Maybe it has to do with the fact of just tending the fire itself. In spite of the fact that everyone else wants to say what you're doing is benign and old-fashioned, or it's not with the times, or whatever. Now I'm just talking about myself.
It's fantastic. Absolutely, Jonah. It's fantastic. You know, and that's the great thing about conversations. I mean, it would never occur to me that, of course, you know, that's a major thing, you know, a major thing, and that's why when this woman mentioned the hearth, that kind of clicked. I'm thinking, yeah, Penelope's on to something. She's dealing with something really heavy and deep, right, and at the very core of human existence. So, well, anyway, we're hoping somebody will write the modern Penelope.
The problem is, what happens in the novel?
Well, you got to have the hearth. You got to have the hearth, you know, and
it sounds more like an epic poem, like something Pound would have done, or something, you know, like
something. Oh, Pound wouldn't have. He wouldn't have one nut to write something that good, man. God.
See, but
God, I hate Pound.
But as I get older, I hated him too. But when I first read him, I was 20 years old.
I like his poetry, but he's a mid-level poet.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's go on, because nobody wants to hear me
bitch about
talk that. About the candles of Pound. Are you kidding me? And
but now
and how there's a Ezra Pound house in Haley that receives probably $100,000 a year to keep going, and he was just there. He was born there. That's all.
Really?
Right.
It's like a museum or something.
Yeah, yeah. And so my best friends really love it. But Vardis Fisher has a house in the middle of Billingsley Creek in Hagerman. That's a gorgeous house that I snuck into after he killed himself.
Yeah.
And saw it with, you know, postcards on the wall from Wallace Stegner, everybody. I mean, all the writers, Western writers in 1968, he was conversing with, and all his books.
This is a great story. You should start from the beginning of why you...
And left, and we had to sneak in through the fish farms. But it was a long summer day like this, so it was, you know, like it was about 10 o'clock by the time we got in there. But, I mean, we walked out. I didn't take a thing, and then we thought about it. And went back 2 weeks later, and somebody got in there and trashed it. But anyway, he gave it to the University of Idaho as a literary center. And in the long run in Idaho, the fish farmers get it, you know. I mean, it just got given over to him. But it had this lagoon with these cormorants, like, flying around. I mean, it was like a magical fairy tale when we did that. But, yeah, I could have been famous. I could have gone around to every Vardis Fisher, you know, university and in the world, you know, and with all my archives and all my original texts and everything.
Well, you probably
would
have been sued.
But yeah, don't get me... There were liabilities, it's true, man. But if I would have waited even 5 or 6 years, with all the treasure trove. I mean, I would have just taken
well,
that, all the...
Well, that would have been a good novel in and of itself. It's like you got to make up the story of how you came into these things.
I would have been become cosmopolitan, man. I wouldn't have stayed in Idaho, man. It was been,
you could have done that. I could see you putting on some facade and like being this...
Oh, of course I would have worn brogues and I would have worn...
An ascot.
An ascot. Oh, absolutely, man. So, what was that sidetrack? But it, yeah, anyway, Ezra Pound. So then we move on to Hemingway, the heroic in Hemingway.
Okay. Well, I had made some marks. Maybe we'll come back to that another day. I mean, we've already done the Hemingway podcast, which would
have... But not in terms of heroism. Okay.
Which had terrible audio. But as I listened to it, I was like, okay, I'm thinking to myself, okay, we're not going to do 100 of these. Let's try and... I can listen to the old podcast. I'll be able to take the best bits of that podcast,
okay,
understand them, and then re-transform them into a podcast that is right, better audio, right, and then right, and then we can do it better that way. But I don't think it's possible,
but
actually.
But you will give me...
I'm not sure.
You will give me the image of Hemingway as the medieval knight with the falcon on his shoulder and his hunting gun and going to war periodically to defend the feudal estate, right?
And, if you want that image, yeah. No,
well,
one
it
can
is,
take
because
it away
he did. Well, what are you talking about? He did, man. He was in three wars. Okay, and then now you go to Hunter S. Thompson,
yeah,
right, who writes Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And this is heroic, but you don't see some sort of connection or declension or anything like that in it then.
Well, so the one I've been listening to is Kingdom of Fear,
mm-hmm,
which is his sort of late stage memoirs of certain past things of his life, which maybe I should have picked something different, but because the more I listen to Hunter, the more I'm less impressed. I mean, I probably should have picked a different book. But
oh yeah, well, you're talking about late stage capitalism.
Well,
late stage Hunter S. Thompson's the most pathetic thing on earth. I mean, Ezra Pound shines compared to Hunter S. Thompson.
Well, I mean, it's fine. It's
I mean,
just,
later stage.
Yeah.
But Fear and Loathing Las Vegas, he sells it, man. He is page after page, and he did it in like a year, and it's funny, and he's got a. You know, he's got a couple lost babes in there that he treats abominably and makes that part of the humor. You know, in other words, the hero as basically a cad, a boor, you know?
The hero as boor.
The hero as totally deranged, just this, you know.
Outlaw hero.
Outlaw hero, but, yeah. but outlaws have always had... You know, nobody ever talks about outlaws' love life. They seem to have women hanging on to them, you know? They seem to hang on to them.
They can't.
Is this from...
They can't. You don't want to be around me. Because I'm just going to... I'm going to destroy your life. That's the outlaw hero. It's like, yeah, you want it, but I can't give it to you.
Yeah. Can you take it, baby? Well, I mean, that's another... Thank you for bringing that up. That's another great motif. The outlaw, you know. Okay, how's he going to treat the woman? Well, there's this myth, you know, this outlaw that treats his girlfriend pretty good, you know. Just robs a few banks or kills a few people so she can live, you
yeah.
know, according to that, Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's there everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, the little sister, I just talked somebody into getting it. The nicest guy in the whole novel is the outlaw, is the seedy guy from Cleveland that has other people kill other people for him, you know. But
well, that's not an outlaw.
But the most
that's a mob boss. I mean, that's
well, that's an outlaw.
You know, I guess. But if you're getting other people to do your dirty work, that's not outlaw hero. That's outlaw. That's outlaw. What do you call
well,
it?
If you got to start, I don't know of anybody
chaotic evil.
Who,
I guess.
No, that's not true, you know, I mean...
Well, if you're getting somebody to do your bidding...
But he's achieved that status, he's achieved that point, and you've got to work your way up, you know. I mean, I'm just assuming. Of course, that's my illusion about America, is that you got to work your way up, right?
Yeah, but as soon as you tell somebody else to kill somebody for you, I mean, that's a line in the sand right there.
But what could be better? What could be better? Jonah, you and I kill somebody that deserves it. We go to jail. Wouldn't it be nice to just have somebody kill them for us? You know, really.
Well,
isn't the greatest pleasure in life being able to kill somebody who richly deserves it?
Nice things are outlawed. Well,
all the good things in life are outlawed, right? Right. Right. So anyway, no, I still go with the outlaw. The outlaw that treats the woman well is the alternative, right? There are going to be more books about outlaws that treat women well than outlaws that treat women badly, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, should there be or is there? It's a completely different question. I mean, is it more realistic that outlaws treat women well rather than, you know, some...
Well, okay, we're going to have a nice little... we're going to have a cocktail party barbecue, and it's going to be Sicilian style because my new friend in town, Jimmy, his dad is Johnny Bricks, meaning he hits people with bricks.
And it's always so subtle, these names.
And they're Johnny Brick.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're just talking, you know, and he just talks about again how great his grandmother's Sicilian tomato sauce is, right? Anyway, and he says he also wants to play poker, you know. So anyway, we're gonna have a great party, man. It's gonna be like,
do you think
food, drink, gambling, everything, man. It's going to be the best party ever.
I would love that.
And Stacy's going to love it. Oh, man.
I would love to see you take somebody in poker. That'd be pretty fun.
Well, it would be new.
It would be new?
It would be a new experience for me.
I thought you had practice at this.
We
talked about this last
time. I'm lucky when I get a good hand, you know, like everybody else. Yeah. But the other thing is I light up so much when I get a hand, you know.
You're too readable, huh?
Oh, man. Anyway, no, and he did say that, the modern mafia, no, it's not like a nice Catholic marriage, you know, with maybe a girlfriend on the side. It's like, you know, maybe a few marriages and a few complications along the way, like five or six marriages, right? So, yeah, you might be right about my illusions about the outlaw.
Well, I guess that's the benefit of the outlaw, is it's allowed to have illusions. The good guy doesn't get illusions. The good guy is cut and dry. You know, he is exactly who he says he is all the time, every time. And that's the problem with the hero. Right? Oh, I mean, the hero can't be complex. The hero can't be nuanced or, you know, messy.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yes. Yeah.
But the intellectual hero, no, that's where the real heroism lies in my mind. It's like, as long as you're right, as long as you're willing to, as long as you're willing to be wrong in the search for truth.
Well, that was Hamlet.
Yeah.
It was Hamlet. Yeah, I mean, he goes through all the ramifications of killing a person, right? And explores it all, and all of its weakness. I mean, anybody that reads it goes, God damn, man, he's pretty damn vacillating about all this, you know. Why does he just kill the guy? Well, actually, you know, killing somebody's something that you're not really sure you want to do, you know.
Yeah.
But and again, Harold Bloom makes the point, Hamlet is the first non-heroic hero that you wanted. And well, let's search for another then. Search for another. Because the guy in Moby Dick is not, you know, I mean,
Ishmael?
Ishmael's a go-along guy, you know?
Yeah. Well, so to be a go-along guy means you're not a hero?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a hero has to...
Well, I mean, it could be, you know. I mean, obviously, in World War II, you're a go-along guy, and they tell you to take a flamethrower and you know, and die. Yeah, absolutely. No, I didn't... I'm not saying that at all, but... But that's kind of like, well, that's real life, and it's cut and dried, and you're right about that. I mean,
well, that was, I mean, I've been reading Campbell too, because at some point we were talking about doing Campbell and the hero's journey, and that's something he doesn't really address. I mean, he talks about myths a lot, but what makes a hero, I think, is an infinitely more interesting question of why should anyone be a hero. I mean, it's not just anti-heroes, but
right.
What is the fundamental aspect of heroism?
Well, that is, you know, you're a brilliant guy. I gotta admit, this is why I hang out with you. That's the point. In A Hero with a Thousand Faces, it's not the hero, it's the journey.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the, yeah, it's all that. Yeah. And there are plenty of heroes, there are plenty of anti-heroes, as long as the journey and the sequence has all the requisite tests,
right?
And also the mentors, the helpers, the butterfly that comes by and, you know, gives you information, you know, all this stuff,
right?
And which brings in the idea of magic. I mean, can you be a hero without magic? I mean, you can be an anti-hero and be a hero. And you can be a hero and be a hero if the journey is complete, if all the parts are there.
But then that's just happenstance. That's just like...
No, that's the point. It's always divine. It's
always divine. Divine.
Yeah. Right. And that's the interesting thing about... that's the interesting
But for
thing.
Us, quanta... What do I want to call this new religion? The quantaists. A series of happenstances happening in yeah. relation where at the end you get a hero is divine. It's just a different version of the divine. It's a diversion of happenstance that comes true. Whatever.
That's the greatest thing you've ever said right there. That's exactly right. I was going to say, yeah, that's postmodernism and the destruction of the hero. And you anticipated that and said, yeah, this is another ultimate heroism, man. But now you got quantum, you know, chaotic happenstance into it, right? And that's the modern era. So I still think there's hope for the hero, but the journey's got to take into consideration, you know,
randomness.
Quantum mechanics.
Yeah,
randomness. Yeah. Wait a second, the lady said if I turned left, I would find what I wanted, and here's this guy shooting at me. What the heck, you know, what the heck, man? Or did she say right? I can't remember, man.
Well, a lot of the hero's journey, like, in technical terms, is just about not dying, right? You know, it's staying alive. I mean,
absolutely.
More or less. I mean, so how could that be over?
Well, that's the point, is that's where the divine comes in.
Yeah.
He will die without the divine. And when you bring in, when you bring in happenstance and just a random world, well, he's going to die in most of these random worlds, right?
Right.
So that would be the ultimate 21st century novel, Joan, and you got to write it.
I'm trying.
How does the hero somehow evade total randomness and survive? You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not so hard, really. The question is, how do you exert yourself against total randomness without becoming the villain?
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
I gotta start drinking this Miller Lite, man. This is great. That's tremendous.
Oh well, you know, it's also due to my. Trying to save up a whole bunch of different thoughts for one podcast, so I can run the room real quick and get as much content into an hour as possible.
You ran it there, man. That was tremendous. Really. I mean, you got to, you know, since we don't have a crowd, we got to give Jonah a little goddamn applause here, man. That's spectacular.
Well, but I don't think that's so true. I mean, I don't think I'm more clever than you in any significant sense. You exert your cleverness on a daily basis, so you actually run through the system of cleverness of interacting with different people on a different.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so cleverly that Friday night, I came out here. Mark has got the ribeyes on the steak. It's 8 o'clock. I haven't eaten for like 12 hours. I've been drinking and playing. I turn out all the lights. I go to every person in here and say, you know, I'm going to close in 5 minutes. 10 minutes pass. Like, the lights are off. There's still people up here, and you know, musicians stand there, kind of talking to them. And I said, kind of like, everybody's got to leave. And they just kind of don't even, they kind of look over the back of me. And I can't, then I went, you got to get the fuck out of here. No, I mean it. Get the fuck out of here. And so they look around. Here's this drunk old guy in a red firecracker shirt and dark glasses, like having a 2-year-old tantrum, like, get the fuck out of here. So yeah. But thank you for your, thank you for your, you know, your tribute to my whatever, man. Oh my gosh, I'm still waiting for the reviews. Yeah, the kind, gentle, courteous, professional service in Old Town Pocatello.
Well, yeah, apparently. Well, I mean, I think you've got all the negative reviews.
That's right. Yeah. That's the point, man. Yeah. Which has something to do with the hero. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
This guy's got so many reviews.
The hero has to be the villain to somebody.
Yeah, I know. Right? That's wonderful, I mean, man. It's wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, that's the whole point of the hero.
Yeah.
Like,
I've gotten so many bad reviews, baby. Don't worry about it. Yeah. That's tremendous. Yeah.
Well, it's like...
Okay, now the Death of a Salesman by Miller.
Yeah, what about it?
Well... The old broken down salesman that has to go into stores. Don't get me wrong, or understand me well. Going cold into a business and trying to sell something is the hardest thing on earth.
Oh yeah.
And here's this broken down guy. You know, he's got 2 or 3 kids. He's Jewish from New York, whatever. You know, I mean, that's a great play, man, and that's the hero. So yeah, but he did give a payoff.
I thought the hero was the son in that play.
No, the father's the father's the hero, the hidden hero. I mean, to me, I'd have to reread it.
But
I mean, that is, I mean, you got kids at home, and you're being a traveling salesman.
Wasn't Dustin Hoffman in a version with that?
I don't know. I'd love to see it. Yeah. All I know is, I have to repeat, Arthur Miller did get his payoff, and you know what that is.
He got Marilyn Monroe.
God! Yeah, you've been doing your scholarship.
Well, it's I don't know. I don't know if I would have wanted to fuck Marilyn Monroe.
Oh,
would you want to fuck Marilyn Monroe?
Oh,
that seems like a lot of fucking work. I don't know.
Oh.
That seems a little. I don't know. Like, I just don't have that sense of. You know, Cooner has that one joke of, you know, if you could walk down the street with one of the famous beauties, or you could actually have one night alone with them, but nobody else would know. What would you choose? Would you choose everyone seeing you with the famous beauty, or would you choose one pure decadent night alone with the famous beauty?
Mm-hmm.
And he argues that most people would choose walking down the street because that's worth more, you know. Mm-hmm. And, like, if you weren't...
But that's his elitism. And that's his cynicism. That's why he's a great writer, because he's a realist. Most people would.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what's wrong with the world. That's what's wrong with human beings. I mean, they're just fucked up losers, man. But there are always people like Milan Kundera and... Jonah Andrist and Will Peterson that are just like, we would make the right decision, man. I mean, we don't want anybody to know. And it would also help if we were married or had girlfriends.
It would. That would help.
Well, I think. Yeah, I think. So I want the my last final thing. I gotta go, darn it. And but we're gonna do a the next set. I hope we do it on Rick and Rosemary's Limberlost review, because there's some nice stuff in there. And I got so into Murakami that when this guy came in last week and had five huge, like 2 foot tall resin Godzillas, I bought them because I was just into the Japanese thing. And it arrived at my thought was the two greatest images of the 20th century were Godzilla and Marilyn Monroe. Jordan is speechless.
I have so many questions about that. I didn't even know where to start. It's almost like, yeah.
I mean, in terms of how many times they've been reproduced, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't pick a male. It's Godzilla. Who are you going to pick? Robert Mitchum, Marlon Brando?
Well, then why would you pick Marilyn Monroe? Shouldn't you pick an equal...
The most photographed, reproduced image in all mediums.
But on your shelf there, you have a semi-priceless book of Norman Mailer's book he did with Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
It's got a bunch of images of Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
And I've looked through it twice.
Right.
Partially because it semi turns me on, but also because she's very normal looking, especially as she gets older. Like, she's not particularly beautiful in any significant way. I don't think, anyway. I mean, when I look at her, I'm like, yeah. Or when you watch the movie she did about wrangling horses in mm-hmm. Reno, mm-hmm. like, every time the camera turns on her, it becomes slightly blurry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, obviously...
For good reason.
Yeah, right? Right, it's because she started...
Part of the contract.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But no, my point is, it is not the essence. It's the image. That I will guarantee you, I'll bet you $1,000 right now, there are more images of Marilyn Monroe than any other person of the 20th century.
Well, okay, yeah. That's...
And then to parallel it, Godzilla. I mean, no male human can compare. But Godzilla, man. I mean, everybody knows who Godzilla is. You know?
Godzilla!
Jorigo-san. This Japanese guy told me how to say it.
Jorigo.
Jorigo-san.
Jorigo.
Yeah.
San?
San. That means mister.
Oh, they would. They Mr.
Jorigo. I learned a lot of stuff in here.
Jorigo.
But anyway, I don't know what it was.
That's funny.
And then the other ironic thing I was thinking, how is it that America and Japan came up with these two images, you know, that just kind of ruled the century? You know?
I don't know, because I'm trying to make the same connection that you are.
I'm just really happy that I finally stopped you. It's like, God, he really is speechless. He's thinking, is Will really this far gone? What can I possibly say to do this? So we're going to resume this next week, because, damn it, I got to go.
All right.
Ark. It's too bad. We're just getting to something.
Ark. Okay.
And I just coined a cartoon word, ARK. ARK. A-R-K.
Oh, what does it mean?
Well, it's better than ARG.
ARG.
ARK. ARK is just a little more genteel, I think, than ARG. And it's not quite as serious.
ARK.
You know? ARG. You're going, oh, fuck, I'm dying.
Yeah.
But ARK. I don't know, I said it.
It sounds like a dog.
I think it's...
it's like half... It's three-fourths of bark. ARK.
What a great way to end the podcast.
Yeah, all right, our shortest one in a long time.
That's great. No, sorry, I gotta
but
do this.
But packful.